Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of Cinema D'Amore. I almost said special episode for some reason. I don't know.
Maybe it feels special.
Maybe we've been doing it. It is a special episode. We're discussing David Lynch, so it's always special. But yeah, this is a new episode of Cinema D'Amore. I am James Reinhardt.
I am Justin Morgan. And we are talking surrealism this month. We're going to be doing... we revealed our episodes on the Phenomenon episode that we did 2 weeks ago. And this, technically, we're recording this on the Monday, February 3rd, the Iowa caucus day.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything that we say sounds outdated at all, it's just it's because we recorded this one 2 weeks earlier than normal. And we did that so we could fit in the Oscar episode this week as well. Try to bring our workload down.
Yeah.
It's exciting stuff, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So, we have an Oscar, which is, I guess, out at this point.
Yeah, the Oscar episode Tuesday and today Friday. So we have to adjust our minds to believing that the Oscar episode that we have yet to record is actually recorded. But really, We don't know what the hell happened at the Oscars.
It's a lot like this movie where, you know, timelines change. It can be whatever you want. And, we don't know. Well, some people don't know what the hell happened. But... yeah, that's a lot like this movie, in a way. So today, surrealism was Chuck's theme, and I've been kind of chomping at the bit to do this film, and here we are finally getting a chance to do it. If you couldn't tell from me saying David Lynch, or if you read the podcast description, we're doing Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, it's I think it's a great movie. Every time I watch it, I like it more. I think I understand it less. with David Lynch, I've almost given up on trying to figure out go on the ride with him.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I've heard interviews and he basically says that he tries to capture feelings and emotions and that's more important to him than plot.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're trying to deconstruct a movie such as Mulholland Drive, I don't really know if you can. I don't really know if it's possible. I have some ideas, but then I'm not so sure of myself the next time that I watch it.
Yeah, I have some ideas, and I was reading an interview with Lynch where he's talking about this movie where he's like, he's basically saying, like, you know, he goes, I'm pretty sure you could watch it and put it together, and he's like, I think most people do, and maybe they don't want to admit it to themselves what it's about. And I think watch it this time, like, I kind of formulated a narrative in my head, but I love this movie, much like you. I like it more every time I watch it. I saw it first in college and I really loved it. I revisited it last year and like loved it even more. And then I bought it and watched it for this and, loved it even more. It's a really effective film. And what you brought up about Lynch of emotion is probably one of the reasons why I like it so much, where so much of this film, like so many of his images, and the things he does in it, they do like elicit some sort of emotional reaction from you. And that's why I've always liked Lynch, whereas I tend to not really dig a lot of the more artsy directors, but Lynch's films always make me experience a certain emotion and feel a certain way. And that's why I've always really enjoyed them.
There's a great interview with him where he's talking about Eraserhead,
mm-hmm.
and he says it's his most personal film, and they ask him to elaborate, and he just says no.
Yeah, I've seen that, and I've seen Eraserhead, and like... most of Eraserhead, I'm like, what the fuck is this movie? But at the end, I felt incredibly unsettled. And I think that's what Lynch wanted me to feel. And that's what I felt.
There's odd relatable things in it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Relatable things in all of his movies, even if it... I mean, this might be the best movie because it is that dreamlike... I don't know. I don't want to say plot. The tone's completely dreamlike. I would say most of the movie is a dream.
Yeah.
But he does a really good job of capturing whatever the hell a dream or a nightmare is. I knew last night I had a bunch of crazy dreams. I couldn't tell you what any of them are right now. I couldn't even vaguely piece things together, but I've had dreams that are like the nonsensical, like in this movie,
mm-hmm.
I guess I should jump into this movie. There's that scene where they're at Winkies.
Oh yeah.
And the guy is talking about this two dreams that he had, and it slowly becomes like the third dream. He doesn't mm-hmm. realize that he's in the dream when he's telling this story, or maybe it's real. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like the way, like, I don't know if it's a happy accident or just perfection on Lynch's part, but it plays out so well when the guy goes up to pay
mm-hmm.
and the storyteller is realizing that, holy shit, it's happening again. Like, it's happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I always really like movies that have dream logic that feel like a dream. And I think Lynch kind of does it best because, like, I don't know about you, but when I dream, like, there's so many disjointed, weird things. But in my head, like, there is a narrative to all this. Like, I know where it's going, what's going on. And, like, with Lynch's films, it all does feel like that, where, like, you have all this weird disjointed imagery, but there is this weird narrative that makes, like, dream logic when you... it does make sense, but in a weird dreamlike way when you think about it, but not in a logical way. And that, I think, is Mulholland Drive. But I love that the first half of it really feels like a dream, really looks like a dream. And then the second half is... half nightmare, I think, half reality. But yeah, it's that scene you talked about at Willie's with the dude and the bum, that's obviously is a classic scene. And I was watching it this time and I was like, this is not a horror movie, but this is like one of the best executed horror scenes in anything I've ever seen.
There's a lot of horror in this movie, I think there's just enough. I don't know. Hollywood loves when movies are talking about Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But he does a great job of... You're talking about that nonsensical, dreamlike logic where things happen to happen, and like in your mind, things adjust. But I also like how when I'm dreaming and it becomes a nightmare and I realize that it's become a nightmare, and it always happens smoothly. It's mm-hmm. not... It could be like this, where me and James are just sitting here talking,
yeah,
doing a podcast. Weird things happening, like maybe in a dream. We'd be recording in a place we would never be recording in, but mm-hmm. I would totally be fine with that. But then something would turn, like there's fucking bears outside that are trying to kill us. Still makes sense in dream logic,
yeah.
But maybe we were having a really nice conversation. It'd be about something weird. If it was a Lynch movie, we'd be talking about toast or something. And then there'd be mm-hmm. bears outside. And I'd be like, that's my dream. It was stupid, but it was terrifying. Like, I was, you know, I scared myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's fitting that this movie feels like a dream because it is about Hollywood, which is a place that's supposed to make your dreams come true. And this film is kind of about dreams versus reality. And I think when dreams do turn into nightmares, where... You know, Naomi Watts shows up to Hollywood. It, you know, a young girl full of dreams, and then at the end, we see that her life is really has become a nightmare.
Yeah, it's. I watched an interview. It wasn't about Mulholland Drive. I think it was about Inland Empire. Mm-hmm. It was right after he filmed Inland Empire. And they asked him if he liked Hollywood. He's like, oh, I love Hollywood. Hollywood's my favorite place to live. It's the place that dreams are made of. It's a very magical place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not without its problems. He's like, there are some serious problems. And I wonder, because the social commentary on Hollywood is like accurate and not depicted in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not romanticized at all. It falls more into the nightmare realm. But it's weird because it's just sort of, I just imagine like wide-eyed, like little boy mentality, David Lynch just so happy to be filming this mm-hmm. movie and pinpointing these ideas. But like, it's funny though, too, thinking about his, like the type of director that he chooses with Justin Theroux.
Yeah.
And it's such an David Lynch-like movie. I don't necessarily... But it's such a... It's the Hollywood story that we've heard 5,000 times before.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, where the producer becomes a monster. Not literally. He does not become mm-hmm. literally a monster in this. And he... when he has that line where he's like, it's no longer your movie.
Yeah.
And the music... Because Lynch does a good job with his sound design where he's just... It just sounds... awful. It's not really a score or anything, but you could tell the Lynch that was the scariest thing, probably the scariest part of his own movie for him.
Yeah, and like, because in the Blu-ray, I have the Criterion of this, and it comes with a booklet where it has an interview with Lynch, and he said about the same thing where he loves Hollywood, he loves living in Hollywood, he lives on Mulholland Drive, that's why it's named that. That's one of the reasons why.
No, this is a little abstract, but I came across something that was questioning whether the movie is actually titled Mulholland Drive.
Huh.
Because the title everywhere is the DR.
Yeah.
And they're like, could it be Dream? I mean, they say Drive because that's where it takes place.
But could it be Dream? That's a good idea. That's a good thought.
Because it's never written out as Drive in anything. Mm. It's always the abbreviation for the street.
In this interview I read, Lynch refers to it as Mulholland Drive. But, you know, I like the Mulholland
Dream. Was it written?
Yeah, it was written.
Maybe they wrote it the way he said it.
Basically, as Lynch tells it, him and Mark Frost came up with the idea of doing a show after Twin Peaks, and they liked the name Mulholland Drive, so they came up with the title and nothing else. And at one point, this was going to be a spinoff of Twin Peaks about the character of Audrey coming to Hollywood to pursue being an actress, but then that kind of fell apart, and Lynch came up with this idea. And it sounds like he didn't really, which I get the feeling this is his entire creative process. Sounds like he didn't really think it through, besides like he had this idea of, you know, a girl comes out to Hollywood to pursue her dreams of being an actress, and, you know, she finds a woman in her apartment who has no memory of who she is, and it would be like that journey, and he really liked that. And then he kind of peppered in these other characters, like the Justin Theroux as the director, the detectives, who we only see for one scene, but all these other characters, it would be all their stories in Hollywood, and most people know this that are familiar with this movie, but you know, if you don't, here's some backstory. But he shot half of this movie as a pilot for a TV show, and ABC, the network, was not very happy with it, and it kind of sat on a shelf for a while until a production company offered him money to reshoot it as a film. And in Lynch's words, he said that was probably the best thing to ever happen to it. But he, when he figured out how he wanted to end it, and he shot that extra hour, and then released it as a film, and, you know, the rest is history. But, to me, as much as I love it, there is a very clear line from when it stops being a pilot that was shot for network TV and a movie. And that's the same time that nudity happens in the movie. I think it's kind of brilliant the way he did finish it and how it came up. But part of me does kind of wonder like what the show would have been like. And I know, like, in this interview he was asked about characters like Justin Theroux or the detectives played by Robert Forster and someone else who you only see in one scene, and Lynch is basically like, I didn't really know where I was going with those characters, but I knew it was a TV show and we needed supporting characters, so I like set them up in this to happen in more episodes and that we'd eventually plan it out, you know, pad it out and all that. But that is that's the backstory of Mulholland Drive. But yeah, he refers to it as Mulholland Drive. And
I think it transitions really well into a movie, though. It doesn't feel, even if the nudity is something that wasn't in the ABC pilot or whatever, which feels weird because it feels very natural to me. Like it fits everything. So if these are reshoots in any way, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it.
It fits really. I didn't think about it till this time I was watching it, where he, because I kept reading about how he said the first hour was shot as a pilot, and then he filmed the second hour sometime later for the rest of the movie. And yeah, it's pretty seamless, but then, you know, we get to a scene where Naomi Watts and Laura Harring start, you know, having sex, and they're both, and I'm like, this is one of the later shots. There's that opening shot where you see Laura, not opening, but when Naomi Watts first finds Laura Harring in her apartment, and she's like behind the shower door, she's obscured but she's nude. I was wondering about that. I'm like, was that meant for the pilot or is that shot for this too? But
that's probably the pilot, because even it's odd to me that they decide to hide her behind the glass there.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's in the shower, she's like, it's an extreme close-up of her face that's wet, so you know that she took a shower. You don't even hear shower water running.
Yeah,
And then later they have that like really crazy sex. Maybe it wasn't a crazy. It's not really a crazy sex scene, but it's very blatant and in your face.
Very steamy.
Yeah.
Like rewatching this, I was like, these sex scenes might be like the sexiest sex scenes I've seen in any movie.
They honestly might be. It doesn't bother me. Like it doesn't feel out of place to me. I think maybe it's just because the movie is such a roller coaster ride throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's just so many things that just super relatable this entire time. But yeah, he does the night his oh man, when the nightmare stuff gets injected into it when they go looking for Diane, go to her apartment.
Oh yeah.
And they find her dead and it's like the most horrific looking corpse ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he does that. Like maybe it's not realistic to what they would actually look like, but it's the most like nightmare induced corpse I've ever seen.
Yeah, even before it gets really dark at the end, like there's these little nightmare things peppered in because there's obviously the infamous scene of the bum behind the restaurant.
Did you know that bum became the nun?
I did, yeah. I didn't know when I first saw this. I didn't know that until I read about the nun and like the backstory of the actress that plays. But yeah, the bum's supposed to be a male character, but David Lynch cast that woman as the bum, which the bum is absolutely terrifying. And I love that scene so much, and I think a lot of people do, but you know, because you know they're walking towards this, you know, the back of the restaurant where this character says he's had a dream that there's an evil man, and like you don't. It's amazing because like any other film, there would have been a fake out and then the scare. And like but it doesn't do that. And you know, so it's the whole thing is like, is there something really back there? Is it not? And you don't really know much more other than the fact that like, you know, this guy is described, you know, this is this dark, evil man hiding behind this restaurant. And then, you know, this hideous thing, this face comes from around the corner. And it's like, it pays off on that nightmare, but like in the best way where, What is behind that wall is just as terrifying as you thought it would be. And to me, that's like one of the best payoffs to any jump scare. So that's very nightmarish. And then the cowboy too, the scene with Justin Theroux and the cowboy, like that scene to me is nightmarish, but in like a very surreal kind of less scary, more just creepy way where he meets this cowboy in the middle of fucking nowhere.
It's because he doesn't have eyebrows.
Yeah, he doesn't have eyebrows and he talks really funny.
And he's very confident in that huge cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the scene with the bum, though, I think the reason that it works so well is he does such a good job building that tension.
Because
Dream's not scary when he's describing it. But the moment that the guy goes up to pay the bill and he's piecing it together that he's like in it again or it's happening the way that he saw it happen before. And he just starts to sweat. And I think those first person shots that are like real shaky and it's just so slow to get there. And it does that Rosemary's Baby thing where like you want to know what is around that corner. Like you want to look around that corner, but you don't want him to go there at all.
Yeah. And like everything's like the camera work, how the camera work, camera's just kind of floating. But you know, it's this tracking shot is beautiful. And then the actor, how he's clearly stalling to see, like, he keeps looking for, like, excuses to not go back there without ever saying it. And, the payoff is brilliant. And
I think, too, because the camera looks like it's going to go around.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that jump scare works so effectively is because that nightmare comes out from behind there when you're not expecting it to. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was half expecting the camera to go around and reveal something, but it's time.
Yeah, that's the thing is like we're on its time, but we also realize that, you know, whatever that thing was just behind the restaurant, it was fully aware that these people were coming to it, and you know, it came out to greet them.
Yeah, and I think it's moments like that that just keep you interested in the film, even when nothing's connecting perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite moments ever is the thing with I can't remember the actor's name, the assassin.
Yeah, the assassin. He played I don't know the actor's name, but I know he played Lucifer in Supernatural.
He was Jacob in Lost.
Oh, yeah, he was.
And Jacob, the guy that is sweating to death telling the story is Phil from Lost.
Mm-hmm.
There might be more Lost people, but those are the only two I can think of. Why can't I think of his name?
We should look it up.
I know his name. I see him in all kind of stuff.
And we're a film. Yeah, he's in a ton of stuff. We're a film podcast here. We should know these things. But yeah, I love that scene where the assassin guy, where he's trying to kill one person and ends up accidentally killing like three.
It's a beautiful moment because he goes to assassinate that guy. And the bullet goes through the wall, and you just hear this yelp.
Mark Pellegrino.
Pellegrino, yeah. Mark Pellegrino.
That's his name. Yeah.
They hear this yelp. And I feel like this influenced parts of The Nice Guys, the Ryan Gosling movie where they just kept accidentally shooting bystanders, just got hurt during their shootouts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's it's really funny, actually, too, because he shoots her, and then he goes next door, and she's like, I don't know if she realizes she's been shot at first.
Yeah, she's like, something bit me.
Yeah. And then he's trying to kill her, and as he's trying to, like, kill her, the janitor sees them, and he's like, she needs help real bad. You got to get over here. But it's just the way the whole thing just goes down is I don't know. It's like very slapstick.
Yeah.
And I don't feel that we get a lot of that with David Lynch.
No.
It's highly enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's still that weird, too, where like the janitor walks in, no expression whatsoever, then gets murdered by that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Then he turns, the vacuum cleaner kicks on, so he ends up shooting the vacuum cleaner to turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that scene. It's hilarious. Lynch does do comedy really well. Like, there was lots of great comedy, I thought, in Twin Peaks The Return. Although, like you said, it's not really slapstick stuff. It's more of just, you know, kind of absurdist humor. But yeah, that's probably the funniest scene in the movie. The rest of the movie is pretty, I wouldn't say pretty dark, like, because there's like, a lot of upbeat scenes in it. For most of the first half of the film, you know, Naomi Watts' character is pretty bubbly and pretty happy and upbeat.
It's funny to me when Justin Theroux goes home and his wife's cheating on Billy Ray Cyrus. And Billy Ray Cyrus is the voice of reason through the whole thing.
Yeah.
When he takes her jewelry box and takes off.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what Billy Ray Cyrus says, but he has sort of like, he has a right to be mad. He just came home.
Yeah. When he walks in, Billy Ray Cyrus is like, oh, you know, like, it might be best if you just, like, walk away. Then, like, yeah, she's like, oh, he took my jewelry. And he's like, oh, he has a right to be angry.
And there's something funny about that casting, too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one thing to have that scenario of you came home early or something, and your wife's in bed with another man.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it played out numerous times in all kind of movies. But the fact that it's Billy Ray Cyrus is really hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, that would be, I think I'd be 100 times more angry if I came home and it was Billy Ray Cyrus. I'd be like, what the fuck's happening?
Yeah, here? And Billy Ray Cyrus, like, fits in some, because, like, he delivers everything so deadpan, and which all just adds to it. Poor Justin Theroux, though, having his directors having, like, the worst day of his career.
I do like that he goes to the kitchen with her jewelry box and finds this can of pink paint.
Mm-hmm.
In the kitchen for whatever reason, and he starts dumping it.
Well, he goes to the garage.
He's in the garage.
He goes to the garage and then brings it to the kitchen and then pours it all over her jewelry.
And it's so funny. And then Billy Ray Cyrus is kind of scary when he starts beating the shit out of him. Like, the way that it's shot, I'd be afraid of Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yeah,
to do, like, punch him in the face hard as he can.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a nightmare. And then it is weird because it's like, I guess on one hand, the Hollywood aspect of making the movies has that, like, magical, dreamlike tone.
Yeah.
But then when he's going to be forced to cast Melissa George as his, like, lead when he doesn't want her.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, like, being threatened. It's his choice, but he's being threatened by the studio to make that choice. Or I'm assuming it's the studio, but they're very mafia-like.
Yeah.
Whoever those terrifying people are, and the guy that's the midget from Twin Peaks, that they look like they put him in a regular body or something. I have no idea what the hell's happening.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, Yeah, I was trying to figure out if they were studios or if they were like, you know, he was in bed with the mafia making a movie of them. And we don't really get many answers to that. And I know, like, in the same interview I read with Lynch, he talked about how, and his mind lots of times into when the studio's giving him shit, like, he just imagined that there's like some shadowy figure in studio that he hasn't met issuing these orders that are then come down to him. So I feel like the dwarf from Twin Peaks, like, that was supposed to be what he represented, like this shadowy figure at the heart of, you know, the studio system that's making these decisions.
And I think you answered that yourself too. It's not really the mafia. It's always Hollywood. It's Hollywood that's doing this to these people. But yeah, this is that. Oh my God. Well, what's the first creepy moment? They do that. They do the dumpster scene with the bum first.
That's pretty early, yeah.
And then we see Naomi Watts getting off the plane, and she's having that nice conversation with that old lady who, when she gets in her taxi with her husband, they just, like, maniacally laugh for 30 seconds or something. It's terrifying. And they come back.
Yeah, they do. They come back. They're just as terrifying when they come back at the end. But yeah, I mean, this film does start off immediately very dark because we get Laura Harring's character. We don't know anything about her. We know she's in a car, and these guys try to kill her, which leads to a car accident, and then she emerges and, you know, hides out in the apartment that Naomi Watts is moving into. We don't find out till then that she has no memory. But yeah, so, like, that's kind of dark. But then, yeah, we get the Lynch creepiness of that old couple that that Naomi Watts was on the plane with.
There's a really cool, I would say, I don't know if it counts as a plant and payoff, but when Naomi Watts' character wakes up, I'm going to call it the wake up, even though it still feels very nightmare-esque.
Yeah.
And she's on Mulholland Drive, and the scenario starts to play out exactly like the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And you think that they're going to off her. So, like, because everything's set up earlier, and we saw that scene with the bum earlier, that it's clearly that's that guy's nightmare twice, and it's happening a third time. So I felt that it was going to play out in that way. And then you see who she's supposed to be then. I can't remember. But when she comes down through the
woods. She's, what's her character's name? Yeah.
Well, it changes.
Yeah.
She doesn't really have a name in the beginning. She thinks she's Diane. And
yeah, then, they call her Rita.
Yeah, she's Rita. And then
Camilla Rhodes.
Yeah, and then Camilla ends up becoming in the dream version.
In the dream version,
it's Melissa George who's Camilla, and then when she wakes up, you said Laura Harding.
Yeah, Laura Harding.
She becomes Camilla, in the second part.
Yeah, and Naomi Watts in the dream is Betty, but she's Diane Selwyn in reality. Oh, that's what I'm calling it. I'm calling it reality.
And I love Winkies too, where they go to Winkies, and there's this when Rita at the time sees the Diane name tag,
yeah,
and she thinks, she's like, oh yeah, like it sparks in her head, yeah, that's my name too, and then we're in reality, and we see the waitress come back over when Naomi Watts is now Diane, and the name tag's Betty,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if that's just Lynch like fucking with us, but everything works out so perfectly. When Rita starts talking in her sleep, and she's talking in Spanish, and then they go to that play, and the Spanish like starts playing out. It is Spanish, right?
Yeah, Spanish. Okay. That's Rebecca Del Rio singing that song. She did a song on the Twin Peaks soundtrack.
I really like the poetic side of it too, where they're like, these are recordings.
Yeah.
And the guy just like stops playing his trumpet, but it still plays. And then they like, so artsy, we'll do it twice. And that's who I'm assuming you're talking about, starts singing.
Yeah.
But then she stops, but the singing, or she, yeah.
She like collapses or something.
Yeah, and the singing still goes.
Yeah, no, that scene is great. I love, and like,
that thing, that woman or whatever that's watching from the balcony.
Yeah.
Has this, like, I don't know, devil-like presence. And she's the Silencio, because that's the one thing that's not... I don't think that happens when they're at the... Do we want to call it a play? I don't know what to call it. I don't think that happens until the end.
Yeah, because we see that character when they go to Club Silencio.
But that's the name of the club, too.
Yeah, okay. But she doesn't say anything until the end. That's the last thing you see is, like, she says Silencio and then fade to two credits.
And I don't know why I like it so much, but when they open the box, I guess essentially Pandora's box, and it wakes them up or, like, shifts them to another reality, I just really enjoy it. It's not just the cast gets to play different characters. And Lynch does a great thing of making you feel like, aha, but still not really understanding exactly what you're watching anymore.
Yeah.
You're like it should, like your brain's telling you it's starting to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of your brain saying, this shit still does not make any sense. To me,
it really is like a dream where, like, you know, in the dream, when you're having a dream, there are things from, like, your day-to-day life that are in it, but they don't quite make sense. Like, people you haven't seen or, like, things that happen to you. Because, like, this is what dreams are. It's just your brain processing the day. But, you know, these things will show up in your dream, but, you know, in weird ways. And I feel like that's what's happening in this, where I guess we can get into interpretations of this movie. Like, dream interpretations, we're interpreting this movie.
Did you bring your dream book?
I did not, no. But the way I interpreted it was, like, all this was Naomi Watts's kind of guilt-ridden dream slash fantasy, where, and, you know, she's Betty, she's a good girl, she's clearly on her way to becoming a successful actress, and the character of Rita is very much, like, there's a romance between her and Rita, but Rita's more, like, dependent upon Betty. Like, Betty's kind of the hero character, Rita's, like, the damsel in distress, she's helping. And then, you know, you wake up and you get to who they are, you know, Diane and Camilla, where Camilla is a very dark character who, very shady, probably has lots of skeletons in her closet, but Diane is but the same and is in love with Camilla and very, very jealous of her.
And she's clearly that, like, addict that was with Mark Pellegrino earlier in the movie when they went to Winkies.
Yeah.
But that's another dream thing, too, where you put yourself in other people's shoes kind of poorly, I guess. Like, it's bits and pieces of you. Yeah, I don't know what to think. I clearly feel like it's not even half the movie. It really isn't. Mm-hmm. It's like a 2.5-hour movie, and the last 40 minutes is, like, waking the woken up world or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
The real world slash nightmare, which sometimes the real world is the nightmare. So, but yeah, I do like when she's the hero of her dreams and she's Betty and her aunt leaves and she finds whoever she's supposed to, Rita at that point, in her shower.
Mm-hmm.
And her aunt and the landlord's like, we don't want this person here. We don't understand this person. And she seems to be super understanding of this person being in her house, which I don't think most people would be. Most people would be like, get out of here. You're not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
And she's immediately, like, trying to, like, comfort her in some sort of way and be like, she needs my help. I'm going to help her. I have to help her.
Yeah.
And there's something kind of, like, nice and innocent about that. And I think that's who we would want to be.
Yeah. And that's what I feel like Naomi Watts' character, Diane, wants to be. But I think most of the action in the last 40 minutes kind of takes place in her apartment alone, and she's flashing back to things. Because, like, when she wakes up in her apartment, her neighbor, who I'm presuming is her ex also, because her neighbor's like, oh, I came by to pick up my things. And she mentions that those detectives came by again. And as we see, in a fit of jealousy, Naomi Watts hires Mark Pellegrino to kill Camilla because Camilla's moved on and she has a new, it's unclear if she's married to Justin Theroux or if they're in a relationship.
I don't think so. I think it's like the,
they're in a relationship. I'm not sure what their relationship is.
I never took it as that she's his wife. I took it as, like, that's somebody that's, like, sleeping with a director to get their name up there.
Yeah, and that's definitely one of my theories, because there's in a dream sequence, there's Naomi Watts goes to her audition, and, like, the dude she's auditioning opposite, he's clearly just using this as an excuse to, like, feel up women. And he's going to do it to Naomi Watts, and she, like, leans into it. Like, she goes with it. And and they're all just like, oh, you did great. You did great. You know, and and when we get to reality, Naomi Watts talks about there was a, she's like, oh, yeah, there was an audition, but they didn't like me. They went with Camilla instead. And I feel like in reality, she turned this guy down and Camilla didn't. That's why Camilla got the part, but Naomi Watts has created this fantasy in her head that, like, Camilla only got it because of, like, shady mob dealings or whatever. But yeah, like, but back to that dinner scene, Justin Theroux seems to be making some sort of, he's about to make an announcement about him and Camilla, but it cuts away before you say it. So it could be like that she's pregnant or that you're getting married, but we also know Camilla has a new girlfriend played by Melissa George, who is Camilla in The Dream. So Naomi Watts hires Mark Pellegrino to kill Camilla. And we don't see it, but I'm presuming that's why the detectives are coming by Naomi Watts' place to ask about her. And that she's clearly feeling guilt over this. And yeah, long story short, but she ends up shooting herself at the end. But that's part of my interpretation of it, is she hires him to kill Camilla, and that's kind of haunting her in the dream. Cause, like, that's why I feel like that's at the beginning, you know, would they stop the car and try to kill her, Rita/Camilla, in the dream. And that plays out like that part, like that memory Naomi Watts had of, you know, being in the car and stopping in the middle of the road. That's how she imagined it went down. But this dream kind of offers her a fantasy where Camilla survives and she's kind of more, and, like, they kind of have this much more innocent romance.
Yeah, and that scene where you were talking about, where Justin Theroux starts to make his announcement,
mm-hmm.
and it goes all quiet, and she's dreading it, and you don't need to hear what he has to say,
mm-hmm.
plays more like a memory, like she's thinking back. So that's the fun thing about this movie, too. At least I have fun with it.
Yeah.
Is it that feels like it's present, but then all of a sudden it's something that was in the past. It's like something that she's just, like, reminiscing about, is how I took it. And I don't know if she's on some sort of drugs too. I took it as they said something about, wasn't Diane, when they found her dead, was like a heroin overdose. Was she shot? I don't remember, but I thought they brought up heroin, or she had a problem with heroin.
Mm-hmm. I think they mentioned that. Yes. Cause I took it like Diane Watts' character was a drug addict of some sort.
She definitely seems like it when she's up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that nightmare fantasy world that continues on, where I'm not talking just about the creepy old little people that walk under the door and then the regular size and they're terrifying her.
Mm-hmm.
But when she actually decides to kill herself, and it's like that insane amount of smoke that just, like, comes up, and it's weird because it's such a terrible moment. This character offs herself, and it becomes that, like, classic Hollywood vibe that Lynch loves. Like, it becomes all dreamlike again with that, mm-hmm. like, a massive amount of smoke coming out from behind the bed. I was just looking up to see what this won.
It was nominated for a bunch of Oscars. And
it looks like the only Oscar I see, well, there's Best Director and I think Best Film. It won a BAFTA for editing.
Hmm.
And the Cannes Film Festival, it won Best Director. It looks like it was winning a bunch of awards leading up to the Academy Awards, that's for sure.
Yeah. As it deservedly so.
But yeah, that's Hollywood for you. Like, that's they get jacked when you make a movie about Hollywood.
Oh, they love it.
The minute you start talking about movie making, they're like, we're in.
Yeah, and especially this, because, like, I wouldn't say this is a love letter, because Lynch says he loves Hollywood, and I feel like he does, but I feel like this is more of a cautionary tale where he's talking about everything he loves about Hollywood, but also, like, what it's really like, where you can get lost in the fantasy of, you know, being in Hollywood, but there's this, obviously there's a, a very dark core to it, and that dark core will destroy you if you let it, and that's pretty much what this movie is. And that's where characters like the cowboy and the bum and this shady studio guys, that's what they all represent, I feel like, is different aspects of the dark side of Hollywood. And I'm obviously the bum, he's rotted and decayed. He's very much supposed to be like the rotted soul of Los Angeles.
Yeah, for me, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of is a love letter in a way, but Lynch is not, I want to say not afraid. I guess he's not afraid. I don't know how intentional he was to show off the bad side of Hollywood. I feel like it just came naturally. I think as he started piecing it together, he's like, this is Hollywood. So he it has this dreamlike tone through the whole movie, mm-hmm. or nightmare. And in reality, it's pretty damn close to how it actually hopefully was, and things are changing. But
yeah. Let's hope. I mean, I feel like Lynch has definitely lived that director's life. I'm maybe not catching his wife in bed of Billy Ray Cyrus, but the...
It happened exactly like yeah. Danny Cass,
no? But I feel like, with the, being pressured by the studio to cast, someone else in the role and all that stuff, I feel like Lynch has definitely lived that.
I mean, he loves all his actors, too. It's like Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern have, like, stuck by his side forever.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like he doesn't dislike people, but he'll connect to them. Naomi Watts came back for The Return as well.
Yeah.
Of Twin Peaks. I think Twin Peaks, The Return is the perfect example of what Lynch would do with television if Lynch had complete control of his television show.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I feel like this, when he tried to sell it as a TV show, was at a different, it was, TV is obviously a very different time. So I feel like that's why this didn't work. When he tried to pitch as a pilot. But I feel like if David Lynch tried to pitch this, it would be very different. I feel like if Showtime's could let him do whatever the hell he wants with Twin Peaks to Return, then them or HBO would have, let him make Mulholland Drive.
He's getting away with stuff that nobody else could ever get away with. Did you watch what did Jack do on Netflix?
No, I did not watch that.
It's 17-minute interview. David Lynch is interrogating a monkey.
I heard about it, but I have not had a chance to watch it.
It's not very good, but it's very Lynchian. Like, it looks nice. The effects are, like, low-bar effects.
Yeah.
They erase the monkey's mouth and put, like, a human mouth there to, like, get him to talk.
Jeez.
The ending of it is great, but, yeah, it takes 17 minutes to get there, and it feels as if it's a lot longer. And then I watched Anthead, which is his thing that came out after Twin Peaks The Return. And it is literally just, he made like a head. He took cheese and they shaped it to look like a person's head poorly. And he let ants crawl over it. And there's like music over top of it. And it's, I think, another like 15 minutes of just that. Nonsense. Yeah.
Sounds about right for Lynch. Yeah, I have Inland Empire from Netflix to DVD, but I wanted to watch it to coincide with this, but I did not get a chance because it's like 3 hours long.
Yeah, that was kind of my problem too. He considers it his companion. He considers Inland Empire to be his companion piece to Mulholland Drive. I believe the way he worded it is, paraphrased from what I can remember. Mulholland Drive was like the acting side of it, and the... Inland Empire is supposed to be like the production side of it, like producing the movies. It's nonsensical and crazy too, and it is 3 hours long.
Yeah.
I got the DVD from Hollywood Video that nobody watched. Like, the minute it went for sale, I snatched it up, and it's wild. I saw it here in Pittsburgh the same day that I saw Grindhouse for like the second time. And I drugged my friends to see Inland Empire with me, and it's so crazy. My one friend was like, this is what David Lynch does to people. This is vivid memory. The guy sitting next to me, he's not sleeping. He's watching the movie. But clearly there's something going on in his head. Like, he's off. He's thinking about something. And there's like this nightmare-induced character that like comes towards the camera, and it's very slow. Mm-hmm. And my friend jumped out of his seat, but like... It wasn't a jump scare. It was slowly making its way toward... It was there the whole time. Like, it wasn't in your face.
Yeah.
And I just sort of love that experience. And another one, I watched Eraserhead once with my mom. And I can't explain it to you because I tried watching movies with her before and she zones out. Like, I watch, I don't know what it's always Quentin Tarantino, but I tried to get her to watch Death Proof with me and she like zoned out. And it was like the scene right before the car wreck. And I'm looking over at her, like, I look over to be like, she's going to like this. She's like looking at her feet. I'm like, will you watch the movie? But Eraserhead, crazy. She watched the whole thing. She said at the end, I don't know what I watched, but I really enjoyed it for some reason. And I can't explain what I liked about that movie.
Yeah.
She said it's the weirdest thing that she's ever seen. And I mean, for the most part, it might be. Inland Empire is probably up there for weird for the sake of being weird. Because Mulholland Drive does feel like there's some structure and some plot happening. There's something happening in this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lynch. I think the only ones I haven't seen, I haven't seen Straight Story. Lost Highway is crazy.
I've seen Lost Highway. Yeah, it's crazy.
But yeah, my favorite one is probably Blue Velvet, and that's pretty straight of a story, like as straight of a story as you're gonna get. Elephant Man's pretty good too, and that's not crazy.
Yeah, I really love Elephant Man. Yeah, I'd probably say this is my top three Lynch's is Elephant Man, not Lost Highway, Blue Velvet, and Mulholland Drive. And I love Twin Peaks. Obviously, I love Twin Peaks to Return. I need to rewatch Fire Walk with Me. I wasn't crazy about that when I first watched it. But now putting it in context with the return, I do want to check it out.
I have been playing around in my head. Maybe I just watch the return or sorry, Fire Walk with Me. Just watch it by itself without having watched the show. Because when you watch the show, you watch the first two seasons of the original show and then you watch the movie as if like the order it came out. The movie sucks.
Yeah.
The movie sucks because it's just basically everything that you've learned in the show is condensed down to this movie. My memory's not the greatest, but I've thought, hey, maybe I'll enjoy this more if I go in just watching it. Plus, it has David Bowie in it. I don't think he's in the show.
Yeah, he's not.
He becomes a teapot or a kettle or something kettle-like in The Return.
Yeah. Oh, in David Lynch's eyes, he doesn't become it. He's inside of it.
He actually said, if I remember correctly, the only mistake that he made in Twin Peaks at all, The Return, was that the spout or whatever he gave to David Bowie's character, he wished he would have did a different shape because everyone was thinking tea kettle when it wasn't supposed to be a tea kettle.
Yeah, and I don't, like, then they're like, why is he, why did he turn into a tea kettle? And David Lynch is like, oh, he's not, he didn't turn into one, he's inside of it. So, yeah.
It's funny, though, too, like, of your, you made a, what, like an 18-hour show, and your only regret is the shape of that machine. It's supposed to be, quote-unquote, a machine that he's become.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've been looking to revisit that, too. I just don't have the time that I feel that I have.
Yeah, no, me too. I get it. But, yeah, because I used to binge all Twin Peaks, like, back in 2011 or so. And at that point, you know, there was no real hope of more, and then I watched Fire Walk with Me after I binged the whole show, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, that was that, you know. And I was like, this is kind of a disappointing way to wrap it up, but yeah, never in my wildest dreams at the point did I think that we were going to get a whole new season, and yeah, here we are.
And the thing I love the most about it is it's not what I was expecting. It was better than what I was expecting.
Yeah.
And it's not for everybody. Like, there's people that won't like it. If you don't like Mulholland Drive, I mean, you might like Elephant Man, you might like Blue Velvet. You might probably are not going to care for anything else that David Lynch makes.
Yeah.
My assumption. Because that's the return. Honestly, I feel if they would have continued Mulholland Drive as a TV show and it would have got picked up, it would have felt more like the original Twin Peaks, where he didn't have that control over it, and you had a bunch of you had the studio coming in and changing things, which is why I already forget because I have a terrible memory. But how you said earlier in this episode, it kind of worked out for the better that he got to just make it into a movie.
Yeah, and he even said that when it comes to TV, he's like, because he said, you know, the studio not picking it up and him getting to finish it as a movie is the best thing to happen to it. But he even said that when it regards to TV, where he goes, when it becomes TV, you know, other people get their hands on it and it becomes something that's not yours. And like, TV is not a very filmmaker-driven medium. Like, I really enjoy TV, but Lynch is very much a singular voice. So I can see why TV, at least at the time, the TV now is more filmmaker-driven. Obviously, Twin Peaks to Return.
They swapped.
Yeah. But yeah, he's like, I could see him think at the time thinking that, because TV, you know, you got studios, you got writers, you got other showrunners. That probably would have really given us something different. Or like, I stand by what I said today. If he was allowed to make this, it'd probably be much more filmmaker driven. Though I also wonder. I go, so can you imagine if maybe this did get picked up then or now? And we get, you know, a couple seasons of what is pretty much a straight story with Naomi Watts as Betty and Rita, and them like trying to solve the backstory of who Rita is. But then he ends the show the same way he ends the movie, where it's all a dream and these two characters are different people and terrible people. Can you imagine how people would react if that was the ending of the TV show?
It's kind of the ending of The Return.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of does go that route. It gets wild in the last episode. Mm. Although, if they would do two seasons of the show, maybe, he lost control of it. After The Return did so well, they'd be like, we need Mulholland Drive, The Return. And he would do it. But yeah. I think it's odd, too, because this interview that I watched right after Inland Empire, he shot it with, a PDF, PD-150. That's the cameras that we used when we were in film school. Digital cameras that weren't that great, but David Lynch shot Inland Empire with it, and he talks, he loves it. It's like his favorite thing in the entire world, because he's like, I don't have to wait days to see what everything looked like. He's like, I can just see that I got the shot the way I wanted it in the first place and then move on. And then Return, he comes out and he wants it to be in film, so I don't know. So he kind of went back on that.
I get the feeling that with digital, a lot of filmmakers, when it first came out, they were like, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, this is the best thing ever. And then as time went, they kind of cooled, or, you know, like digital and film have very different looks. And I feel like, if, you know, eventually they decided that, you know, a lot of people liked how film looked. And, you know, that's that.
Yeah, but there's even filmmakers that have stood up for digital saying, I know you lose the process and you lose that magical side of movie making. But it's gotten so good that you can make it look like anything that you want it to.
Yeah.
You can give it that slight grain. You can, you know, like we were, I don't know if we brought it up on this in any of our episodes, but There Will Be Blood. I remember Paul Thomas Anderson shot the film and then he exposed the film to a different type of light afterwards to make it look older or feel older.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like, think about how risky that was to do to your movie. I mean, I don't know if he did it in pieces before he edited it, but nowadays you could just put that in your computer, see what it looks like, and be like, nah, or adjust it in any which way.
Yeah, I think it takes a balance. Because, like, I've seen films that were shot on digital, and they've tried to make them look aged, and it looks really cheesy. And I've seen a lot of films shot on digital that just look cheesy. But I also think it depends on what you're shooting with, how you shoot it, you know, what kind of effects you have and stuff like that, you know. But, I mean, I tend to, shooting on film or digital, I always tend to feel like whatever suits your medium better is what you shoot on. Because, like, you know, Nolan's films, he shoots on film. Tarantino shoots on film. And their movies, I think, always look pretty great. So I think there is an argument to be shot on film, but I see the appeal of digital. And obviously, I've only worked with digital, and I've edited film before, and it fucking sucks. So it's not my bag, but, you know, to each their own.
It's another sort of, it's not necessarily the tool. It's how you use it.
Yeah.
Because I've been trying to get better with my photography skills. And everything I read's like, it's really not the camera. Like, a good photographer can make, like, any camera work the way that they want it to work. Just a matter of like actually learning the equipment and not relying too much on like the auto. So I think if you're not lazy with it and you've experimented with it, yeah, you could make something pretty wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so that's, I don't know. There's a lot to go into on Mulholland Drive. Cause I feel like you can interpret it a lot of different ways, but that's how I interpreted it. But yeah, I love this movie. It's probably one of my favorite Lynch films. Like, what about you? What are your final thoughts?
I love this movie, and I really wanted to talk about it for some time. And rewatching it for this episode, half of me says, like, I don't want to break it down. I don't want to try to, like, demystify it and try to figure out what the hell is going on. Why Lynch is making certain choices and stuff. I don't necessarily want to be a critic, even though we kind of are critiquing everything that we talk about on the podcast. But yeah, I honestly feel it is probably his last good thing since The Return. Lynchian is now a word in the dictionary. It's a harder thing to describe, but once you watch one or two of his movies, you know exactly what people are talking about. They're talking about Mulholland Drive to a T when they're saying this is a Lynchian movie. It's got that, seems like it's out of context, but right on the nose at the same time. That's Lynch for you.
I feel like, yeah, Lynchian is a word, but I feel like nobody's really can really replicate what he does, because I've seen other Lynchian films, and they all kind of miss the emotion of his films, and there's also like a sincerity to his work, and I feel like The Imitators don't have it. Like, I really do feel like he is a one of a kind filmmaker, and that's probably why I love his film so much. Is because he's such a unique voice, and I don't think anyone can really be like him.
Yeah, and when we were doing our Tarantino stuff, I think that's the same thing. You can't emulate that person at all, even if that's kind of the story you want to tell. I love them, but I don't. You, that's like, people would be like, he's ripping off David Lynch right now. And you'd like, how do you defend it? You'd be like, yeah, it does come off a lot like David Lynch. So it's just sort of like he completely owns the style of filmmaking. And I can't think of anything that has done it well. A lot of indie movies will play around with that kind of dreamlike scenario. But I wouldn't want to go there either. I don't even know how I would do it. If somebody was like, we want to make a movie, it's got to feel exactly like Mulholland Drive, I feel like you would feel like, oh, Justin and James, they made the Mulholland Drive ripoff movie. Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Not the remake of Sunset Boulevard. It's a ripoff of Mulholland Drive. But yeah, it's really weird to me because for the podcast, we have to talk about it. We have to come up with some sort of dialogue. And I do like it, and there's things that jump out to me that I love about it. There's almost not anything in the movie that I hate. I feel like every choice, and it's perfect. And maybe it's because it comes together so perfectly at the end, or at least it feels like it does. Like, Lynch has tricked me into being like, yeah, that was a nice ending. I have the Blu-ray, too, but I watched it straight through. And I think they might have kept it the same way. But did you have the DVD when it came out? When the DVD came out for Mulholland Drive, specifically, Lynch would not allow them to put scene selection on it. So there was no scene selection. You couldn't skip through the movie. So if like, you watched 30 minutes of it, I guess you could fast forward, but if you just did the skip button, it would end the whole movie.
Oh, like, I didn't know that, but I didn't have the DVD when it came out. This first time I bought it was on the Criterion Blu-ray.
I feel Criterion does the same thing. However, most Blu-ray players, at least, they'll be like, would you like to resume where you were at before?
Yeah, because it did it to me. I started watching it one day, and I finished it another day, and it just resumed from where it was.
That's Criterion's workaround. They're like, Lynch, we didn't put on scene selection because we know that you didn't want it. Then on the backside, they're like, but the Blu-ray players, they'll remember for that. Yeah, next week, Chuck's pick, El Topo, which I've never seen. We're also throwing in Sonic the Hedgehog, which currently I also have never seen.
Yeah. El Topo I'm interested in, because there's like a David Lynch-type connection there. Jodorowsky, the director, almost directed Dune. And then, obviously, he left it, and then Lynch came on.
I do have one recommendation. Criterion also came out with the David Lynch, The Art Life. It was on Amazon Prime. I don't know if it still is. it's not necessarily about his filmmaking. It's kind of like his early life leading up to right when he started getting funding for Eraserhead. So it's not David Lynch, the director, but it does dive into David Lynch, the artist, because for a long time he just wanted to do like sculptures and just art in general. And it's really interesting. I don't think it'll give you a better map, idea of who this person is. I also have his book, was it Room to Dream? Mm-hmm. Never read it. Came out last year. Hmm. But I'm a little slow. I just read The Outsider, so I'm a little behind on my books. But yeah, that's all I wanted to say, because I'd be kicking myself if I didn't bring up the art life again. Oh, and I think we brought it up on our podcast too. But when we did our Blue Velvet episode, that was like, there was something that came out where like rumor on the street was like Criterion was looking at Blue Velvet. And I was like, I know that announcement. And they made the announcement the day that that episode came out.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it was about a year ago we did Blue Velvet.
Yeah, they made the announcement. It came out a couple months later. But it kind of, to me, it kind of sucked too, because I bought Blue Velvet, I think, right around that next Criterion sale.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched it yet. I watched it for our podcast, but yeah. I didn't get to rewatch the like apparently new restored cut from the negative.
I haven't. I bought it on Criterion. I haven't watched it yet either. I'm sure I'll get around to it.
We've seen the movie. Yeah. We're just bad at getting to things that we buy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's all I think that's it. I think that's all I gotta say.
I think that's all we gotta say on this. Mulholland Drive is a film I think everyone should see, and I love it.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. We're Cinema de More. I'm on Twitter, JJMorgan19. James is also on Twitter.
I'm at James Reinhardt.
Our Cinema de More Twitter is at Cinema de More on Twitter. / Cinema de More on Facebook. That's where you follow us to see what we're doing next, which I told you.
Mm-hmm. You did. You gave spoilers.
I literally think it's... Sonic the Hedgehog is next. Sonic the Hedgehog is next. And I made some teases for it that I have, like, I don't know why I like the dumb ones, but the dumber they are, especially our last Jallo.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenon. I love the art of the monkey with John Travolta, like, in the background, like the moon or something. To me, it's so stupid, but I'm so proud of it. I'm like, it's the dumbest, most proud moment I've had.
Just as long as you're happy with it.
Yeah. So, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, that's where you subscribe, rate, review us. If you're enjoying what you're listening to, please download the episode. That's how we know if you like it or not. I mean, we kind of do our own thing anyways, but we would like to know what people are particularly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
It's David Lynch or Sonic the Hedgehog. That's how we know.
Yeah, let us
know. If we don't know, we just do more Sonic the Hedgehog stuff. Sonic the Hedgehog month. We only have one movie, but we'll just keep talking about the same movie. Mm-hmm. I feel really bad that I had to bring up Sonic the Hedgehog on our David Lynch episode.
It's surreal. It fits in.
It does seem very surreal.
Yeah.